This bonus series was launched in cooperation with SIX Swiss Exchange. It focuses on companies that completed the Sparks IPO Academy course, a six-month fast-track IPO training program designed for high-potential scale-ups. And now, on with the show.
You know your partner. You know everything. You know kind of weakness and strengths. And the probability that you break half a year later is much smaller compared with, you know, somebody, a team which you have to assemble all newly.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Sylvan.
Reto, a very well welcome to the Swisspreneur Show. It's a pleasure and an honor to have you here today.
Thank you, Sylvan. It's a great pleasure, actually, to be here, and thank you for the invitation.
You have a very impressive story to tell. You are the president and former CEO at Topadur, a biopharmaceutical company developing disruptive therapies for aging diseases. Before we talk about that chapter, I actually want to go a bit back in time to start with your personal background. You got your PhD in chemistry from the ETH back in the early 80s. Then you went on to the United States for your postdoc in California and also Harvard. How has your time in the United States shaped and also changed you?
Well, I would say significantly. Also, I mean, it's many, many years back. But when I was in California, this was Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. When, you know, the tech industry started in garage companies, yeah. And we had actually parties with many of those people, and, you know, every evening. So coming from Switzerland, where, you know, we were hardworking at ETH, this was a completely different environment. Mm-hmm. And that certainly has influenced me. Also, the stay on the East Coast, you know, Harvard, business-oriented, pure business. So that these two stages were extremely important for me. Also in California, my wife worked at Stanford in the hospital. Back then, I was involved in organ transplantation, and she treated actually patients who, you know, were very much depressed after the transplant, because in those years, survival was kind of very short, even kind of considering the surgery went well, but the foreign organ was not accepted by the body. Yeah.
You know, often we say there's sort of an American way of life, and Americans think bigger and are way more ambitious than we here in Switzerland. Did you also experience that yourself during your time there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many different American ways of life, you know, and especially if you are in a new university environment. These are global environments. I mean, postdocs from all over, from India, China, US. And so this certainly, Stanford, Harvard, these are special environments. In terms of kind of the big cities, the, you know, the fast-moving places. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's the speed is different compared with Europe. However, you also discover in the States villages and smaller cities where you believe, you know, that Stone Age, that's last century. Yeah. So I think it's the diversity is most likely much larger compared with Switzerland.
It seems like you got the best, you know, from the East Coast, but also from the West Coast. But then you decided to come back to Switzerland in 86. Why did you decide to come back and not stay in the United States?
Well, there were several reasons. I had actually job offers in Stanford. And kind of, you know, whenever I flew back to Switzerland in that 2.5 years, the environment here is clearly different. We have kind of, you know, spring, winter, summer. California, to be honest, it's boring weather-wise, mm-hmm. You know, the whole year. So that was clearly kind of an eye-opener when I asked myself, where do you want to live with the family? Mm-hmm. Then I still had very good connections to the ETH. I had an offer from the University of Zurich, and I had kind of my friends at Sandoz, which I got to know during my PhD at the ETH. So yeah, that's kind of this experience on drug development. Mm-hmm. And back then Switzerland was clearly the leading place to be for pharmaceutical companies. So that was probably the push thing from Switzerland, yeah.
I see. And then you actually went back here to Switzerland and you also started to work at Sandoz, the famous company here in Switzerland. How was your start there?
It was great. I mean, it was in a time when, you know, there were many job openings. So I, back then there were in Basel three companies, Roche, Cyber-Geigy and Sandoz. Mm-hmm. I visited them for 1 week, and when I left, I had from all companies job offers. So it was kind of the golden time for employees, and equally well, you were received starting at a company. Mm-hmm. So, and it was when Sandoz implemented the very first immunosuppressive drug. I was kind of involved in that during my PhD, and 2.5 years later, I joined that research team who brought it to the market. And this was an extremely interesting time. And you had the surgeons visiting us, kind of, you know, asking us to provide this. It was a natural product to provide this disruptive drug candidate. Mm-hmm. And for the very first time, patients survived not a week, not 2 weeks, but, you know, for years. Yeah. And that really influenced me a lot.
So when I understand you correctly, the attractiveness of the problem and the scope of the problem that you were tackling was basically making the decision for you which company to choose as a career step.
Yeah, it was certainly not the kind of the financial conditions. Mm-hmm. They were fine with all companies. Sure. Of course, you know, there were slight differences. But it was this spirit on research and entrepreneurial spirit, really, even in a pharmaceutical company, mm-hmm. which led me deciding back then to join that team. It was a completely new area.
Yeah.
So that's...
And it was a very interesting time, because then later Sandoz merged, went through the merger, and Novartis came out of that, basically. How did you experience that time of, you know, a lot of stuff happening, a lot of things changing, but also moving and getting bigger?
Well, that, of course, that was both an interesting time, but also uncertainties. So, you know, I had many colleagues which back then were a little bit older. Of course, they also feared to lose jobs, because mm-hmm. when companies merge, some of the jobs are redundant, and that happened again. Now, soon afterwards, of course, there was this spirit of, yes, let's kind of, you know, enter into this new area. And I remember very well, there were two key individuals. One was from Cyber-Geigy, Alex Krauer, and the other one was Daniel Vasella. Two of them completely different personalities, mm-hmm. but both of them had the same objective, really, to develop this kind of new company, which came out of two rather weak companies into a leading company. And that really happened. I mean, Novartis was for quite several years number one in pharma globally. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, it was an extremely interesting time, many, many changes. And looking back, I think all of the changes were really positive.
So it was a very exciting time for you to be part of that story as an employee and important contributor.
Yes. And of course, you know, in that time, you really feel the environment. This fuels you to, you know, do your job, to really try to have high performance. So it's like in sports, you know, once you are number one, it's much easier actually to compete and stay ahead of the others. Yeah. That was the, exactly this time, yeah.
But imagine also quite some pressure to actually stay number one at the same time.
I don't feel that. No, okay. I never felt that. I felt excitement, and it was not driven by fear. It was really driven by excitement. Okay. And as long as you see every year kind of the progress and new things which you can do, I think that was at least my driving force.
Great. There's one other thing as part of your education that I quickly want to talk about. In 2003, you decided to get your MBA from the University of Zurich. Did your interests shift a bit away from science and more towards the business part, or why was that a great decision for you to get an MBA as well?
Well, the shift occurred a little bit earlier because back then I was really a research manager. I was heading departments for 500 people. And so obviously I learned that on the job. Now, my supervisor back then, when I took over a new function, he asked me whether I had some interest. You know, the company would support that and pay for that. I already had in my mind to actually incorporate a company. And so I felt, yeah, why not? Yeah, you know, kind of learning from scratch. And I did this MBA, an executive MBA at the University in Zurich. It was excellent because it was an environment where I met many interesting people from completely different industries. And that opens your mind. That really kind of, you know, drives you again. It was like the merger of Sibgaik and Sandoz, yeah.
It seems that you had this great environment of fantastic people around you multiple times in the US, at the merge, and then also at the MBA.
Yes, I was lucky in life. I mean, of course, it happens once or twice that you meet people where, kind of, you know, it's not the best match. I had that also twice in my life. But overall, I really must say I was always lucky. You know, right time, right environment, and that stimulated me.
To be fair, you also have to expose yourself and take that step to fly over, you know, the ocean and basically say, hey, I want to go to the US to make that happen eventually, right?
Yeah, in chemistry back then, this was kind of the normal education process. So I wouldn't call myself special, certainly not in that sense.
Now I want to talk about your business. Topadour, you founded the company in 2015, but you actually have been working on Topadour before that, since 2009. What have you been working on during these 6 years?
I founded Topadour because I was pioneer in an area where I succeeded and brought a drug candidate into development. And back then we decided to stop that because we had an adverse effect in animals, which later on was clear that this was animal specific. That can also happen. Yeah. And kind of, you know, our competitors, they got to know the idea and they succeeded. Mm-hmm. And back then, actually, I felt, I need to create a company where decision-making is easier compared with, large corporations, where it's transparent. When, you know, you take the wrong decision, everybody knows who took that decision. Right. And so the flexibility is much larger in small areas, and the speed is clearly higher, much, much higher.
But at the same time, you were leading big teams. You had a fantastic pharma career.
Yeah, I earned enough money, let's put it this way. But kind of, you know, as a manager, the creativity is, I would say, limited. You know, your daily job is really kind of, you know, to play referee between employees who, you know, have a problem with each other. And that's not research. That's really not how I wanted to spend my time. So what I did in the first 6 years, I had my very nice house and with a large Swiss shelter in the basement. And so I did chemistry. I went back and synthesized hundreds and even thousands probably of molecules. And you know, that's the research spirit. Mm-hmm. You, as a chemist, you are like a designer. You design your molecule and prove the hypothesis with biological activity. So I started to collaborate with an Indian company and there was a French company, everything myself. So, mm-hmm. you know, that was my hobby instead of playing golf. And yeah, it turned out to be successful. So the first 6 years was the basis of the company. And then I founded an AG and they merged the previous company, then brought in the co-founders. But it was exciting, you know, kind of my wife probably didn't enjoy it that much because I occupied all of the cellar rooms, including the, you know, washing room and with many equipments. And when we finally started in Schlieren, actually, I moved all of the equipment out of the house. And the relationship with the wife improved a lot, I would say. No, just joking. But that was an interesting time.
But to put it in a different perspective, you were also a bit unfulfilled or unhappy with the manager role because to actively develop or do the research yourself, that was missing in your role.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, chemistry is a creative profession. Yeah. And of course, if you're lucky, you know, you get these managerial jobs, you are paid much better, of course, which enabled actually that I was able to, you know, incorporate the company. But yes, this creative element, the experiment, that gets lost a little bit. So when I started in managerial positions, 200-300 people at Sandoz, I still kept my own lab. And that was absolute chaos because, you know, in the morning I came and started the reaction. Then I had to run away for a meeting and I told the technician, just do the workup. Yeah. She didn't know what was in the flask. And of course, you know, time to time I came back 3 days later. Yeah. And that was for her not kind of the most motivating times. But then when I had my own chance to do the synthesis myself in the cellar back home, you know, that really was a great time.
I see the motivation part, right? But at the same time, you also had, maybe it's a bit frankly put, but like a golden cage, you know, very stable income, high income, great career. Didn't it hurt or take some guts to say, hey, I leave all of that behind me and I now start my own company again?
Well, there were some trigger factors. So it was not only myself. Yeah, I remember when we discussed the company and planned for incorporation, I was a little bit scared indeed of, you know, the risk. I was a little bit scared also on, you know, would we run out of money?
Of course.
And I remember I was for Novartis in California, and this was roughly a year after we started to discuss the company and the program and so on. And then I got this email from my financial colleague, and she just dropped me an email, Reto, I did quit my job in order to start at Topador. Now, back then, the company was not incorporated. The company didn't have money. So what I did myself was I just gave the company a loan, no interest. But actually, you know, the year later, we would have been we would have a problem because we still didn't had investors. Mm-hmm. So that was close. But to be honest, it was this person who really did put me under pressure to incorporate now. Yeah, yeah, that was interesting.
It's like, hey, Reto, I'm going to do it. Are you in as well?
But you know, this trigger factor, still, time to time you need them. So it, you know, I would kind of not be honest to say everything was done by myself. You know, you, time to time you need this pressure. I had great life as Novartis, so I didn't had any problem to leave Novartis. Actually, I wanted to leave earlier. They didn't want to let me go, and they asked me to stay. So we did an agreement, which also secured actually my financial situation. So I, from that side, I didn't have a problem.
And you mentioned that you then brought in co-founders in 2015 to actually start the company after you did the synthesis yourself in your cellar lab, basically. How did you meet your co-founders and why were they the right people to embark on this adventure?
Well, as many things in life, you know, serendipity, you know, run into each other by chance. So one person who was a competitor of mine, you know, who kind of copied this Pathfinder story I mentioned before, he worked for a German company. And, you know, then he retired and kind of since this company succeeded with my idea, I went back to this guy and said, you know, I want to start in this area. Do you have some talented people which you happen to know? And he mentioned this medical doctor who was the key person to develop this competitive competitor drug based on my own idea. And I felt, you know, I want to know this guy who basically, you know, succeeded on my idea. Yeah. And that was one of the co-founders. The other one was his boss. Mm-hmm. Then I had Christina, who I met at Novartis. She was an external person. And by chance, I asked her, or her brother, do you know anybody who can do my finance stuff in the previous company? And he said, yeah, my sister. So, you know, that was serendipity. Yeah. And the last person, you know, I'm a researcher, so I needed somebody who was very familiar with development, drug development. And so just by chance, colleague of mine who was running at Novartis, the technical operations, he retired and I said, Armin, I need you. Do you want to join? And of course, you know, that's how it happened. Then I had a toxicology expert. So back then, you know, this was a team of experienced people and I met all of them during my previous life. Yeah.
Sounds like a great starting point.
It is, because I think, you know, Silvia, if you know your partner, you know everything, you know kind of weakness and strengths, and the probability that you break half a year later is much smaller compared with, you know, somebody, a team which you have to assemble all newly. And so, yeah, I like relationships. I like sustainable relationships. This really helps in life.
I like that. Let's talk about the early days then. Mm-hmm. What kind of drugs or therapies did Topadur develop early on, starting from 2015?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was intrigued by, after the merger, this was 96, there was another key event when the Actelion founder approached me and asked me whether I would like to join. Mm-hmm. And I rejected that because I had a good job at Novartis. It was just a year after the merger. But I was always following that success story. It's an absolutely great success story. A team coming out of Roche back then kind of succeeded on a drug candidate, which the big pharma company felt, you know, there's no money to make. But, you know, it was a blockbuster drug candidate, more than a billion sales every year. And the reason for that was it's in rare diseases. Mm-hmm. So rare diseases, even smaller companies can actually succeed because it takes probably a fifth of the capital. It takes much less time, and the revenues on average per patient is five times higher. So this is exactly the kind of the ingredient, success ingredient Actelion had. And then I followed this idea. We are in a very similar space, disruptive drug candidates for aging diseases. And we focus very much on a rare disease. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that really is a story in Switzerland, which unfortunately has not been duplicated so far. I hope we can do that, and I'm actually convinced.
I hope that your story inspires more people to consider this as a focus.
I mean, compared to the time when I started, you know, there were very few biotech startups. Mm-hmm. Some of them succeeded. But if you look at the environment nowadays, yes, I mean, many companies have actually been inspired, not only by me, but by many people, and especially by success stories.
Can you talk a bit more about how people or patients that use Topadur's offering, basically products, how they actually benefit in their lives by doing so?
Mm-hmm. Well, we focus on a central problem in an aging person. And this is insufficient local blood flow in different parts of the body. Mm-hmm. Wherever it occurs, you know, if it occurs on scalp, we lose our hairs or the hairs become gray. If it happens in skin, in aging people, the skin gets thinner and thinner. Mm-hmm. When elderly people are wounded, they don't heal their wounds because blood flow, local blood flow, should bring in nutrients for cell proliferation and closure, making new tissue. It doesn't happen. The wound stays open. And mm-hmm. then we have the things which we all know. We lose our vision strength. Many of the ophthalmic indications have to do with insufficient retinal blood flow in the backside of the eye, or you develop colon cancer. That person I mentioned, who was the trigger factor for Topodo, she died 3 months ago in colon cancer. Now, from colon cancer, now we work in this area. And I lost my main investor because of diabetic foot ulcer. We work in this area. And, you know, kind of if your environment influences you like this, suddenly you know that you have to do it. Mm-hmm. And so what we'd like to do is to correct insufficient local blood flow, bring it back to normal, mm-hmm. in order to fight these deficiencies and avoid people to die early or suffer early from those diseases.
And how do you do that? Where does your therapy start? Well, I know it's probably very technical, but
I can explain it very easily. You know, when I started, there was this a great drug in development, which later on was called Viagra, mm-hmm. a famous drug. I was involved in that area very early. And I even, actually, back in St. Louis, patented sildenafil, which is the active ingredient of Viagra from Pfizer, as an inhaled drug. So we kind of blocked that. Then a year after I started with my company, Topodur, there was a key paper which said, if you use the Viagra ingredient, the drug candidate, sildenafil, put it on top of a wound, you increase local blood flow and the wound can heal. Now, this is half true, only half, because in many people, the drug is not potent enough to diffuse into tissue and actually have a maximal efficacy. Mm-hmm. And so back then, the idea was born, well, it's very easy. We only have to make a drug which is probably 10 or 50 times more potent. Yeah. Now, on that journey, we discovered this dual mode of action drug. So we work on two different targets. One is the Viagra target. The other one is the nitroglycerin target, so to speak. And the combination of small molecules addressing both targets at the same time resulted in a potency increase of more than 3,000-fold. When I started pitching, if you pitch for startups, if you are number 7 or 8, people nearly fall asleep. Mm-hmm. When I started, I always said, well, we have these drug candidates, which are, more than 1,000 times more potent than Viagra. Everybody was awake. And of course, that helped. That helped.
Right framing. But thank you for explaining that in simple terms so we can follow. How do you actually then solve the financing at the very beginning? Because that's one of the tough trade-offs, right? When you develop biotech, it's basically a higher risk, higher reward case. You need usually quite a long development cycle. You still need quite some funds to put something out to market, but there's basically no revenue and only a bit of traction with some trials. So how did you finance the company to actually then, build some traction?
Well, I was lucky. I had a good salary from Novartis and the previous companies. So I was able to put quite a bit of money in the company myself. Yeah. And this skin in the game, how we call it, really helps to convince also investors to build trust. And so I reached out to investors. I reached out to mainly people who founded their own companies. And of course, I had my network from Novartis, and then we did competition. Mm-hmm. And so, the story obviously had some content. So after competitions, many of those we did win in Switzerland. And, after those competitions, you really built your image, and then you have people approaching you. I only have private individuals, cantonal banks, two small companies and one small family office. Mm-hmm. And these investors, these bases really help you. They come with patience. Mm-hmm. They know that pharma is risky, of course. Yep. But once you succeed, you have an excellent return on investment. And that's exactly what they want to do.
It's very classic, high risk, high reward, right?
It sure is. I, of course, say, what we do is just high reward.
Of course, you have to as a founder.
Yeah.
How much money did you need in total to get together, to fund everything you've done so far?
Well, so far we have something like 32 million Swiss francs, out of which 26 million is equity capital, and the rest are grants. We were quite a bit with grant proposals, and we got some European grants, we got some Swiss grants. Mm-hmm. And that also helps because these are experts which review your grant application. And if you win that, that's also an instrument with which you can convince investors, and especially because you have this money which comes on top of the equity capital. And so that helps. Altogether, we currently believe that with roughly 180 million Swiss francs, we can bring this drug candidate to the market for the rare disease. Yeah. And so in a common disease, you would need at least 1.5 to 2 billions if you go for a global market. So we have one equity round left now, and then we basically have the IPO financing plan. Altogether, we should get from that roughly 180 million. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, we have a couple of early out-licensing opportunities.
Got it. And where do you currently stand in terms of developing and going to market with your product?
We have three different drug candidates in mm-hmm. development. The most advanced is in so-called clinical stage 2A, where for the first time you go to patients. Okay. Now, the first clinical phase is also a major hurdle, because that's where you go from animals into humans. And I've seen it in the past quite often. There are unpleasant surprises possible when you do that. Yeah. With all of the precaution, toxicology and so on. It happens often that humans react differently to animals. And so you can lose many compounds there. Mm-hmm. We had a great phase one in healthy volunteers, and we even had an efficacy parameter where we got the information at the end of the study. Yes, it's nicely tolerable, but it's also efficacious. And we now like to show this in patients. This is the most important value creation step in the development.
Got it. And you had a remarkable career at Novartis, but now after starting your own company, you didn't fully cut ties with Novartis, because you were then able to win Daniel Vasella, the former CEO of Novartis, as board member for Topadur. How do you make that happen? Because I imagine he gets many, many pitches, become an investor or get on a board. How did you win him over for Topadur?
Well, I got to know Daniel, of course, you know, when he really shaped Novartis. And I had the pleasure to work with him on the Novartis campus. This was his visionary project where he did build a modern work environment in order to be stimulating for, you know, discovery companies and science-based innovation. And during that probably 10 years, we developed a relationship. And, you know, about 3 years ago, called him, asked him, you know, do you remember me? And he did. And we had a good time, because I really admired him for the things he did for the company in Switzerland. Yeah. And he is also criticized from the outside, but I think he created so much value that he probably also remembered me because of the relationship. Mm-hmm. And then I must say, ever since I have him on the board, it's great. I mean, he's a medical doctor himself. He's very much focused on medicine, and he helps me a lot when it comes to patients, to clinical strategies and things like that. No, I it's a very good relationship, and whenever I need him, drop him an email, and very soon afterwards, we have kind of a digital discussion.
Fantastic. So that can really help you to build a successful company, right? To have people with that, not only personal brand, but experience and network and know-how.
Yes. I think that's, you know, since I know him, and I have a couple of people on the board who I knew before, and I know their competence. So it's not the name. It's really what these people bring to the company with their experience.
Yeah, I see. Before, you mentioned IPO as one strategic piece to get the necessary funding together to really launch your product into the market. And one thing that you're currently evaluating is the Sparks IPO Academy. This is run by Six, and you recently participated in that program, and it basically helps you to prepare for an IPO, as the name already says. First of all, what motivated you to participate in this very specific program?
Well, it's probably the same things which motivated me to get this executive MBA. When I didn't need it anymore. Now, also, an IPO, it's the first time in my life I try an IPO. So obviously there are things which you have to learn first, and either you try to do it yourself and make all of the mistakes, or you go through a training program. And then I wanted to do that program a year before, but back then we were on a journey for an US Nasdaq IPO. And of course, you know, that was when I was excluded from the Six workshops. And a year later, when, you know, kind of we rediscussed this strategy at the board, and the valuation in US dropped for biotech companies, you know, I asked again whether I could be part of these workshops, and I was accepted. And it's really kind of a couple of things which intrigued me. First, you get to know again all different types of industry, and you learn from them. You know, it's not only watching, but different industries, tend to develop their own kind of strategies and really to keep their eyes open and get to know them helps a lot. So it's kind of the team, it's participants, and then you have the professionals who, you know, did IPOs or supported IPOs for many different companies, and you want to know, you know, what's the recipe for success, what's the recipe for failures. Also, I must say, not always this may work, of but course, at yeah. least you try to avoid the biggest mistakes.
Yeah. And what are some of the key takeaways for you from, you know, this academy?
Well, I think the key takeaway is that we still can do good IPOs in Switzerland for biotech. Mm-hmm. And this was not only the academy, it was also a couple of success examples, which I mentioned. You know, one was certainly Actelion, great IPO and followed afterwards with success. And so I'm convinced it's not only US or the larger European stock markets where one can do IPOs. Switzerland is a good one. And there are advantages in Switzerland. Probably we are not that high-speed environment as you mentioned we have in Nasdaq or US, fewer shark investors, but investors which have patience and believe in value generation takes time.
Yeah. And, you know, as a businessman or entrepreneur yourself, you do have to come up with some pros and cons of doing an IPO. Is the IPO even something that you would consider, or is that for you a clear goal where you say, hey, IPO is the only way for us that we really want to pursue, and here are the pros and here are the cons, but for us it's a clear decision that we want to do it?
Well, for me, the most important thing is to bring the drugs to the market.
Right.
So, you know, and whatever supports that is the right thing to do. Yeah. And so in order to do that, you need money. We need roughly this 180 million Swiss francs. And, you know, the IPO primarily is there in order to provide this money. Now, obviously, you have different scenarios, which we also discuss at the board. You know, what happens if a company wants to buy one of our products? What happens Sure. if a company wants to buy the whole company? Now, we always kind of evaluate these things like, you know, what are the best chances for sustainability, for bringing that drugs to the market, not what brings you most money. Mm-hmm. It's really sustainability, drugs, patients and employees, jobs, and of course investors, you know, return on investment. But the company is owned by a community of investors. And decision-making is also clear. So you have to develop in the leadership position, you have to develop scenarios and transactions. You have to bring that to, you know, the shareholders and ask for their input as well.
I like it how you frame it, because it really seems to be a means to an end to do the IPO, to follow your big vision, to bring the drug to the market.
Yes, absolutely.
So what are your next steps and the timeline regarding a potential IPO?
Well, the next steps are clearly to achieve the milestones which we need for the IPO. And the milestones are positive clinical patient data. This is the most important one in the wound healing. Then we have a great drug candidate for medical cosmetics, a kind of skin aging. You know, this is not life-saving, but it would help us a lot for financing this company. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is a drug candidate for the ophthalmic indications where we currently conduct critical animal studies in a disease model. That should be ready probably first quarter next year. So it's we are driven by achieving the milestones. As soon as we have the milestones, then we actually can start the journey on the IPO. Now, of course, there is also timeline planned based on the assumption all of the milestones are achieved. Yeah. And in terms of that timelines, we think that we can do the IPO early in 2025.
Got it. There's one important development I want to talk to you about last. And this year in 2023, you actually decided to step down from your role as CEO at Topadour. It feels it's quite early. I know you're like 8 years in and the 6 years for the development, but still it feels like the company's just getting started, you know, getting ready to push the drug into the market, ready for the IPO. Why did he decide to step down as CEO?
Well, basically, again, this is triggered by the IPO. And, you know, I had this dual role. I had the CEO role and the president of the board role. Yeah. So strategic. And I was kind of my own boss, which, you know, for an IPO is not optimal.
Fair point.
And then when I brought that to the board, you know, we had the discussion, would somebody else wanted to lead the strategic part and governance part? And the board felt, no, Reto, you do that. And kind of then we evaluated for about half a year. Mm-hmm. Should we bring in a new CEO? And I wanted to do that early because it really takes, I think, roughly a year till, you know, your organization is ready and mm-hmm. really has splitted these two different roles. And we are in the middle of, I would say, the transformation process. So I'm every day in the company. I'm from very early till late. I'm running the research part. I still do many operative decisions together with the new CEO. So this really helps him to come up to speed. And I think middle of next year, actually, we should feel both of us very comfortable in our new roles.
So for now, except for the title, not that much has changed yet from your daily work life.
Yeah.
But it eventually will, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's not about titles. It's yeah. about capability and processes. Yeah. And so the title I can change within a second. Processes and adherence to processes and capability learning, you know, that takes longer.
Absolutely. And how was that for you? Was it easy to let go of that CEO title or role? Because from what I hear now, it's not that much has changed, but merely the title.
Well, certain things has changed. And of course, you know, it wasn't easy because, you know, it's your baby, it's your child. And to let go, it's probably the same as, you know, if your child leaves home. Yeah. Of course, on one side, you're happy because that child has, you know, grown up and you know, developed, and you know in order that this child can further develop, make their own way, you need to let go. Yeah. And I consider this thing very similar. When you know, when I discussed it with Daniel Vasella, he said, "Reto, make sure that the employees don't come to you. You need to find ways to give the new CEO also a chance." And exactly this has happened. You know, the first 2 months, of course, everybody still felt it's the same. Reto is here, we ask him. Yeah. And then you have to force yourself and really think about your child. You know, what's best, not for me, but what's best for the child? Mm-hmm. What's best for the company, for the development?
Yeah. That takes reflection, but also discipline to then execute in the daily business, I assume.
Yes, but yeah, I'm not sure. You have to ask the others whether I have this discipline.
Sure.
I would probably not be the person to give you a fair. I believe I can do it, but no, yeah.
Have you at one point also thought, you know, you framed it the right way. You said having both roles, CEO and president, is probably not the best way to go into an IPO process. But at the same time, this change could also backfire a bit, saying, hey, you leave a very important operational role, a CEO, and that could potentially hurt your fundraising endeavors. Was that also a thought along the process?
Yes, of course. And it's also something which we experience. So I'm still doing fundraising. Mm-hmm. And kind of with the argument that the board actually is just kind of the shareholders, kind of employee, so
right,
to speak.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it's a function of the board to have this contact to existing shareholders or new ones. Yeah. So with that kind of thought in mind, I still do all of the fundraising. And the new CEO, he really liberates time for me because he cares for the team. He cares for some contacts, external contacts. So I already feel that I have more time for these things and also more time for strategy.
Fantastic. So you already described some of the next and most important milestones for you to tackle and to achieve as a company. But what is next for you personally, Reto? Where do you spend your time in the next 1 or 2 years?
Well, yeah, I have to be careful because, you know, my wife usually tells me what she expects me to do, but I still believe that as long as I have fire, I'd like to stay in this company and contribute to maximizing value. It's all about maximizing value. It's not about the individuals. It's really kind of the company, the products, employees. And so I certainly, after an IPO, I would try really not to have any involvement in the operations. But to be honest, I'm not sure whether this will happen.
It's your passion, you
it
know,
is.
The fire that
it,
you described.
It certainly is, yeah.
I love that. So to wrap up the conversation today, we also prepared some rapid fire questions for you. I either give you different options to choose from or a short question,
okay,
and you have to answer in one sentence, ideally.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah, I try.
Let's go. How many hours of sleep per night does it take to run a company?
Well, 6, 7.
Do you often regret your decisions?
No, never.
Have you ever regretted like coming back to Switzerland instead of staying?
No,
no,
never.
Nothing?
No, I enjoyed both things, but never regretted, no.
What does money mean to you?
I have enough.
If you hadn't studied chemistry, what would you have studied?
Medicine.
Medicine, nice.
Yeah.
And is it better to be a middle-aged entrepreneur or an entrepreneur in their 20s?
Middle-aged, I'm not. I'm actually much older than that. But no, I think the value is actually the team should have both. You know, younger people, elderly, more experienced people, younger people with much drive. So I think it's really diversity and which is the strength.
I think that's a winning combination. Mm, experience, but also speed,
yes,
and drive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Reto, thank you so much for coming on the show. Lots of success with the IPO and with everything that you're working on and tackling. I hope this fire continues to burn for much, much longer.
Thank you, Selma. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.